Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
Welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Caligaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And today I'm extremely pleased to be joined by Neil Pleasance, who's the Head of Digital Product and Design at Mindful Chef. Welcome, Neil.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm thrilled. All right. So you and I have had a little chance to talk before, but for all the people who may not be familiar with Neil, let's start with a little bit about your background and how you got to be so passionate about design.
Oh, wow. Gosh, I'll just get way back, probably to the beginning of digital itself. I was a TV and radio producer working for the BBC over here. And one day they asked me if I'd like to take my content production skills and work in a interactive TV department. I had no idea what that was at all. I was put into a room and it was the very first time I'd ever met software engineers. And I think it was the first time they'd TV producers. So it was quite odd for the first 10 minutes. But then we realized that actually between us, we could create the most engaging interactive content that sits through via a certain button access on the remote control. And back in the year 2000, that was witchcraft, really. So I got to know software engineers, they got to know us, and we went on to just become great friends and create some of the great content. And I fell in love with digital media from the off. And I've never left it in the 22 years. So my first 10 years were all in broadcast media, making TV widgets, which were supposed to be the next big thing and kind of are coming about now. They were a bit ahead of their time at the time, but I did 10 years of that and interfaces around TV stations in Europe. And then I moved into retail through Amazon, which was really cool because they taught me really about the beginnings of, I guess, personalization. How can we take information that we know and get them to stream more content and then buy more things? And so I fell in love with digital all over again after 10 years or so. And I've been in retail ever since. So I worked for some of the big UK companies, largely in food, but I've ventured out into other areas. But I've done about 8 years in digital online food. And I have to say, that's probably where my passion is.
Well, I'm very passionate about food. You've found good things here. Good food, good design. I mean, I'm in. But for those maybe who aren't familiar with Mindful Chef, what is Mindful Chef?
So Mindful Chef is a recipe box. I guess over in the States, you do it as HelloFresh, competitors. Yeah, so we do the same thing, just slightly differently. Our focus is all around health. And so we are a recipe box subscription based around health. So our motto is healthy eating made easy. We are dairy and gluten free. We make sure that we have high quality protein. So 100% British meat, grass fed, and free range chicken. All of our fish is from sustainable sources. And nice. We're B Corp registered, which means our impact on the world is registered through that scheme. And we're in the top 3% of food and beverage companies within that. The greatest thing we do is we have a partnership with One Feeds Two charity. So for every meal that somebody buys from Mindful Chef, we give a free school meal, to a poor community in the world. And so far we've donated 50 million school meals.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's pretty cool, right? It is really cool. You feel awesome before you even sit down in the morning, I have to say. Right? It's really, really cool. Yeah.
Yes. Anytime you can be as passionate about the product and the company, but also sort of their ethics and contribution is a great thing to be. So, well, thank you. One of the things you were talking about your background, and you had that sort of like the meeting in the wild, the first time a software engineer meets, right? And kind of digital and those pieces. But I think that is a common theme in your kind of background, right? Like the alignment of the organization and different groups. And one of the other things I know you've talked about is being outcome focused. So I'd love to just sort of explore a little bit more of those. So let's start with, what do we mean when we say outcome focused?
So for me, outcome focused is aligning digital teams with the rest of the business, which isn't mm-hmm. always the case. And that forms aligned targets and outcomes. So we all work together to go in the same direction. The outcomes are the results of your activities. So it's where we test and learn. We move forward with continual improvement to solve the problem. The alternative to that is, I think we'll be familiar to lots of people listening, which is the feature factory. So it's a scattergun approach, lots of features, no validity, no continual improvement, no test and learn. And what becomes really the build trap? So lots of wasted time, money, and builds that nobody uses. And, you know, you repeat that cycle because people panic and they say, okay, we need more ideas. And so they go back into that vein again without actually giving thought and the right research and the right discovery to what the right solutions are as a business.
Excellent. All right. So outcome focus, everyone going around design, making sure we're focused on the right things, not just building things, but creating the outcomes. And how do you use that to kind of align? Is it everyone in the organization? Are there particular groups in particular that you partner with in this concept to kind of get alignment?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing you're going to need is trust and patience throughout this whole thing, especially if you're just starting off. And that is a key theme, really, of everything I have to say, because without the trust, you're not going to get anywhere. And without really approaching it in the right way to solve business problems as well as customer problems, you're also not going to get anywhere fast, because you know, business problems, customer problems, they need to balance out. You can't solve customer problems if there's no business to solve them in, right? So, that the output of that creates your portfolio. So when you start to align the teams, you first of all have to look at, well, where are the teams? Are the digital teams ingrained into the rest of the business? Because if you're not doing that from the off, you're failing. You know, you just have two silos of work that are ongoing and maybe the odd thing will work. So you start with the senior levels of management. It's certainly the way I try and approach it. You get buy-in by explaining what outcome focused is. And, you know, you need to put that really clearly and simply to them and get them to understand how that means that if everybody's working together to go in the right direction, then your outputs are going to be much better. So I don't like to say the word outputs, but that would be the eventuality of working in outcomes. So it's hopefully win-win. And then you work your way around the business talking about outcomes, and everyone suddenly starts talking about outcomes because it just becomes the norm, which is one of the most effective ways that you can spread the word of outcomes across the business. But there's lots under that in terms of how you need to work with that trust and patience, especially building the trust across lots of different business units.
When you talk about outcomes, and I think you're 100% right, it's that focus on both customer outcomes and business outcomes. Is there a formula for creating a good outcome and sharing it? Or is it from both perspectives at once? Or do you kind of have customer outcomes and business outcomes?
Yeah, so clearly, I think when you're looking at customer experiences, digital customer experiences, I think it's for anybody that's been doing it for a while, it's clear where the issues are. That might not be where the business needs you to focus. Mm. So for example, especially now, you know, everybody's in quite tough economic times. Businesses have, especially online businesses, right, have done really, really well out of the pandemic. They've seen a lot of trade have a massive growth spurt. And now we're coming off the back of that. It's starting to plateau, if not drop. So their focus is, okay, guys, you know, like any business, we need more customers or we need to make more profit. It's going to be one of those. So what you're focusing on as a customer problem might not actually get you to solving the problem of how do we increase profit or grow more customers. So by aligning and saying, okay, we're not going to focus on this part of the experience, say, I don't know, checkout or something. What we're going to do is we're actually going to focus on our onboarding journey to get more people in. And then you're aligned with the business. And if you're aligned with the business, you get more support. And then you start to all swim in the right direction. You get to launch something quickly because that's the whole point, right? And then you test and learn and you improve. What I think a lot of people do wrong is set out on this path and they say, okay, we'll try something. And they go, okay, we'll try something as an outcome. And then what they do is they try something and it doesn't work first time as an MVP. So they roll back to what they had previously rather than let's keep on the good path. Let's keep going forward, continually improving and make this the best thing.
Because I think that's one of the ways outcomes work, right? The outcome that you want still matters. It's just that wasn't the way to get it. And if you focus on that, then you go, okay, that's fine. We'll try a different avenue. We're not abandoning the goal of making that experience and that outcome better.
Definitely. And that's you've got to be a bit brave to do it, right? Especially when things right. And that's the thing is it's trust and patience, because you're not always going to get buy-in initially, and you're not always going to be able to convince people. And one of the ways that I've tried to do it in different companies, aside from going in with a plan, is looking to attach myself to support agents. So people who, you know, if you're going into a company or you're trying something new, there might be other people who have a lot more, who've gone through the pain a lot more than you have, should we say. If you can persuade those guys who have the trust of senior leadership, maybe more than you do, if you can persuade those guys to get involved, then they'll do a lot of the hard work for you and speed things up for you. And that's certainly what I find going into a new business. If I can align myself with some of those people that have been through the pain barrier of that, it helps enormously.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of aligning yourself with support agents, what other ways have you worked on the trust and patience? And is it different now when so many companies are remote?
No, I don't think so. I mean, obviously it helps if you can spend some time in groups with people, because, you know, I think if you're online, for me, I don't know about anybody else, but you're on a Zoom call or something or Google Meet, you have to work a lot harder, you know, to get your enthusiasm over.
You have to be intentional, for sure.
Yeah, no, totally. I think I'm quite lucky because I'm one of those really annoying, over-enthusiastic people most of the time.
Perfect.
Great. I'm going to call you every week. So one of the things that I do is when I go in, I like to observe, learn, and then take action. Going back to the trust factor, unless you start walking in other people's shoes and understanding the pain they're going through, they're never going to trust you, because that you're going to come out with all these ideas. And, you know, if you've been doing this for a while, you kind of have an idea in your head what it means to solve some of the problems and what those are. But you've got to convince other people, and they're not going to be convinced by you unless you can understand all the problems that are involved. So when you go and observe, you have to walk in their shoes. You know, and that certainly for me, it means going to quite a few warehouses, been to lots of warehouses that sell lots of different things to understand how the operation works, because everything that we do in retail ends up with a box going out of a warehouse somewhere to a customer. So you can go along and you can start and say, oh, you know, okay, show me around the warehouse. And personally, I love it. I'm a bit geeky like that. And so you're in warehouses, you start to gain their trust, and then you go and spend some time with acquisition, and you say, okay, you know, what are all the problems you're doing? You sit with the acquisition guys and you can see what they're trying to do. And then you sit on customer care calls and you can hear customers, you know, berating the call agent. So you've been through that walk with them. And so therefore you've observed and you've learned a lot and you've gained massively a lot of trust. And that's the most important thing, because then they can say, you know, Neil gets it. He's been here a few times and he understands where we are now and what he's trying to do solves that problem. So again, you're getting, by osmosis, you're getting those support agents already, so which is quite cool. And then you have to form your plan and then you have to take action. And certainly for me, certainly getting into Mindful Chef, I mean, I did observe, learn, and action, and I can break that down if you need me to, and the things I tried to do and the outcomes I wanted. And I knew that that was going to lead to customer experience changes, because that's my remit. But I also wanted it to make sure that it changed ways of working. And outside of a multitude of processes that I think, you know, needed to happen, a lot of that was also how we get to become outcome focused.
So when we talk about getting everyone aligned, I know one of the things we also talk about with the outcomes is executive alignment and buy-in. Is that also like a trust and patience? I mean, trust and patience always helps with everybody. Yes. Is that the focus of working on executives, or is there another kind of aspect of that as well?
Yeah, you have to include the executive team, because, I mean, certainly in small and medium-sized companies, if they don't buy into it, you've got nothing from the off. So, and it could be that the scattergun approach had seemed to work for them for several years. You know, they've seen growth, it's working. Why question it? But I think it's when times get hard, that's when you really need to say, well, okay, the way we have been working previously, it's no longer going to work with the scattergun approach. We have
some kind of shift often prompts the change, right?
We have to be careful with the money that we're investing into those teams that are building something. So I would say, you know, in small, medium-sized companies, they're the most important one to get on board straight away. And that's where change and support agents help.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing, again, with outcomes that's so powerful, right? Again, we don't change outcomes all the time. As or sometimes I think with development teams, they feel like they're getting batted around, right? Like the priorities are always shifting. But that's often, again, because we're not talking about the outcome. We're talking about a little piece. And so it can feel very scatterpointed. If we're talking about outcomes, not only does that help with just sort of like, what are we prioritizing? But I also think for the executives, it can be a good level to focus on, right? Like we don't need them in the, not the weeds, but of the details of how, if we have alignment and confidence and sort of resourcing to focus on the outcomes.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing, because Otherwise, they will dive into the weeds, you know, to see what's going on. And, you know, I've seen that happen. It's not uncommon. Whereas when you're aligned with all of your peer stakeholders and other people in the business, and then you can kind of approach it from a collaborative team, and collaboration is key across all of this, then it makes it easier for them, because they're suddenly like, well, I trust this person, I trust this person, I don't know that person very well, and Neil's new. So, but if these people are saying it, it must have something, you know, and therefore they start to trust. So they stand back a bit, and then they hopefully start to see the results. But I think you have to be very clear with them that results are not going to come quickly initially while you change over from a kind of feature factory approach to a outcome focused approach. That can take, you know, a good few months to start to bed in. So there's going to be a slowdown in output potentially in terms of, well, what we're building as digital teams, what we're designing. But what we do create will have a lot more focus across the business, certainly have a lot more discovery and a lot more contact with customers. And therefore, all those things are very, very key in moving the business in the right direction, because it's more considered.
So if the outcomes we're focused on, right, we're focused on outcomes that both have a customer and a business impact, and we're using that kind of combined language to help everybody buy in. And we talk about results and how it might take longer. I can't imagine that the metric is like outcome achieved. Yes, no, right? Are there other ways that you can measure either progress towards the outcome or the outcome success?
Yeah, I mean, an outcome, you know, when you're saying, what do we want to achieve? It's usually, well, why don't we increase acquisition by 10%, or why don't we increase retention by 10%? Or why don't we, you know, make sure that more people get through the conversion funnel through checkout by 12%? Mm-hmm. And they're great problem statements to have. I mean, they need fleshing
out. Everybody wants those things. There's no one else listening is like, meh, maybe I won't. Those are good things.
Sarah, I mean, I don't know a retail company that doesn't want, you know, more of that, to be honest.
Right, yeah.
Be a very odd retail company if they did. but that's the thing. So then you start to look at, okay, how do we turn that into a problem statement? So I get what you want. How is it? And it could be, well, the solution to this is to sell more tomatoes or to sell more red kettles or, you know, whatever it is. That's where there's high profit. We're not selling enough of those. Let's focus on that. And then maybe we'll solve some of the problems. So you have to, you know, break it down for them and solve it in a different way. It can't always be, you just need to make me more money. I mean, clearly, you know, for any business, you have to do that. But some people think that, you know, when you talk about objective key results, that's what they think. Your objective is, well, you need to, you know, increase profit by 10%. And you're like, no, that's a key result. That's not the objective of what we're trying to do. So you've got to think of, how do you turn the business problems into business statements? And then what do? You hand those over to, well, hopefully it's part of your product strategy because you're aligned. And then you hand those to teams who can really start to work on the discovery of those problems, start to understand it, talk to, you know, get insight, get data, start to design, show those designs and the learnings that we've been through, and then start to build something pretty awesome.
Love it. So you talked a little bit, you mentioned product and design, and I know that's a space in your career that you've spent a lot of time, right, in that connection. So I would love to hear a little bit about how you approach that relationship today. And, you know, like, everybody loves a good story. So if you have stories where they haven't gone as well, or, you know, a good times when you've really seen the power of the alignment, those would be great.
Power of alignment between digital teams or business teams?
Between product and design teams in particular, yes.
Yes. Do you know, when I started, there was a very, very clear difference between product and design. And I think there still is, but hopefully I'll come on to explain why I think they're merging together a bit more, actually. So back in the day, product were, and probably still are, a bit of a business unit. So they work in, we need to enable growth, either growth of new people coming in or the business money that's coming out of it. And designers and UX guys would sit there and say, okay, well, we need to do this journey. I think fundamentally that hasn't changed. What I have seen change is a much closer alignment that actually we're not trying to do each other's jobs. And, you know, and even more further than that, I've seen a lot of great UX people become great product managers, and I've seen the odd product manager become a great UX person. So, you know, it can work both ways. I think by its very nature, if you're doing UX and design, you have a fundamentally brilliant understanding of, you know, how to get people from A to B to C to D, or sometimes not from A to B, you go through B and just go A to C. You know, that's what they do. That's why they're so good. And I think what I've seen over the years is that alignment coming together a lot more. Initially, I think there was some, kind of after a few years, there was some struggle around, are we doing the same kind of things? But where I've seen it work best is where actually it doesn't matter who's in your team. You don't care about your remit. You care about the outcome that you're trying to focus on. And once you start to get over that whole piece around, oh, I should have thought of that idea, or I need to have all the ideas. It's just, just the ideas that come out of that team are key. It doesn't matter who came out with them. Because if you follow that through, then the CEO of every business should have every idea, right? And who wants to work in a top-down environment like that? Nobody, you know. So I've seen it work best very much when people come together. There's no conflict. It's just, let's work together to solve some problems, get some great stuff and watch things grow. Let's watch those metrics go up. I think certainly I've seen that work best at companies that I've worked for in the UK, like Tesco, who is a huge grocery company, actually the biggest in the UK. They have that mentality. Let's just work together. Let's just solve the problem, keep working the problem, and let's see, you know, what happens on the other side. I've seen it work not so well, if I'm honest. So, and when it doesn't work well, you have to step in and you have to solve that conflict. And that conflict, largely in the cases I've seen, and I can only talk about that, have been around egos. So going back to that whole, you know, actually, I've got all the great ideas. This idea is mine. I'm not prepared to bend my idea. I'm not prepared to alter my idea. This is my idea, and I think it's a winner. You know, so it's when you get too many people in the team that are like that, or even actually just one or two, it destroys the rest of the team. And therefore, everything you do, you know, to solve the problem drops massively. So I've seen it work both ways. It always works best. And certainly where I am currently and the last couple of businesses I've been in, it's just worked brilliantly because everybody's there to solve the problem.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Is one of the things that we teach and we talk about and people definitely talk about is roles and responsibilities, right? Mm-hmm. Going into a project, going into a team, really spending the time to have clear roles and responsibilities. And I think that can be really helpful. I think though, if you have that without the idea of shared outcome goals and trust, that can also be a place where whether it's ego, it's like, no, I own that, right? I'd make all those decisions. So it doesn't matter if the developer had a good idea about the UX or the designer had a good idea about sort of the problem to solve. If we're too focused on that, right, then that's again where we're not hearing and listening and we're worried about something very different than can this team together create a specific outcome?
Yeah, because you're not worried about what the outcome is. You're worried about how you're seen, you know, to everybody else. And look, I mean, that could be driven somebody new coming in and their insecurities within a team.
Yeah. So they feel you're trying to make a point that you will be helpful, right?
Absolutely. I'm good. Well, that's the thing. It's like, I would say to those people, and I do, there's a reason you're here. It's because you are good. You don't need to prove that you're good. You know, you know that. You've been through lots of interviews to get to this stage. So forget the imposter syndrome and forget the ego. Just let's focus on the problems that, you know, we're here to solve.
I would add too that it's probably good when you start somewhere new to remember that the people you're joining are there because they're good too, right? Because sometimes, right, like there is like the new person just assumes everyone did it incorrectly or you know what I mean? So I think that's a really good point. I think it goes both ways, right?
Yeah,
we hire eight players. That's why you're here. That's why we're here. And together we're going to make amazing things happen.
A 1,000,000%. And that's the beauty of it. And the other great thing about getting new people in is those fresh eyes. You know, no matter how you try to keep your eyes fresh, you know yourself. You get somebody new in and you're like, oh, yeah, wow. That was sitting under my nose for how long?
You know, right.
They just come out with something obvious. And you're trying so hard as a group to try and solve things. Sometimes you miss the obvious. And, you know, I say that to my teams a lot, take the breaks, you know, go for a walk. And our offices are based on the River Thames in London. So it's pretty cool to go out and go for a walk and then come back. Just look at something new after half an hour and you'll soon start to see, oh, yeah, actually, when we look at it like this. And that's what new people are great at. So certainly building great teams is, you know, something that's crucial. Because you know that you need different people in your teams. You're not just along the diversity route, people with different backgrounds, people who've come from different genres of companies, they all combine to make great teams.
How did you, I mean, were you always focused on outcomes? Did you kind of go through the progression of, you know, agile and these things? Or how did this come about for you?
It clicked through lots of observation and lots of people talking about it. Going to conferences, all that kind of thing. And when I first started out, I mean, Agile didn't exist. It was XP, extreme programming, you know. So, and then Agile started to come in and then all the different flavors of Agile. And then people were talking about different styles of ways to do things. How can you move from waterfall? That was the first big thing, which, yep. which is brilliant. So that's good. Let's leave that one well in the past and move over to agile. Okay, what does agile mean? Well, you've got all these burn down charts and, you know, you've got velocity and it's like, okay, but can we chunk that down any further? What are we focusing on here? And then you start to see people who are coming out with the outcome methodology. And once they start to break it down, you know, people like Marty Kagan, who do talk about it a lot, people within Mind the Product, you know, talk about it a lot. So big organizations like that. And suddenly you start to think, you know what? That's so true. That is true. And like I was saying, if you go into a business and start talking about outcomes by osmosis, you all talk about outcomes. I think it's the same with those guys talking about outcomes. Suddenly the community of product and design start to think, yeah, you know what? Outcomes is the way to go. I just don't think it's happening fast enough.
Yeah. Well, and that let's go there. So you've got some people listening that are maybe newer in design, and maybe they're not used to thinking that way, right? Maybe they're very focused, and if they're thinking about outcomes, they're thinking very customer-focused outcomes. How would you help them to start thinking about outcomes and also start thinking about outcomes in a way that would resonate with the business partners that they're working with?
Yeah, totally. I think, first of all, don't think that outcomes is down to senior leaders within the business, because actually they're probably not even thinking about it. And the one thing I encourage people to do is go and find out about meetings that are happening that you think you might be able to either gain something from or input something to. And so I'm pretty sure if you're enthusiastic enough and you go up to somebody and say, oh, I hear there's a meeting about X, would you mind if I just joined in there? Because I think I'm working on this project and I'm thinking of doing something like this. And you may have some answers within that. I can't think of anyone that's going to turn around and say, not a chance, you know.
Get out.
if they're in my company anyway, they shouldn't say right. Come along, have a listen, see if you can take anything out of it. And you know what? If you input and you come out with some amazing things, keep going to that meeting. If not, if it's not for you, it's not what you thought, great, you've learned something, you've moved on. But I would say to people, look, you've got to be the change you want to see. I know it's an old saying, but it's a very relevant saying, because sometimes if you don't get up and do it, nobody does. And the chances are there's lots of people, if you start talking to people in your teams, you know, even on your peer level, even if you're a junior designer or something, you start to realize that other people are thinking like you are. And then suddenly it becomes a conversation. So you go and see decision makers and you say, okay, why don't we start to do this? You know, there's a saying in the UK that shy kids get no sweets. So, you know, if you don't ask, you're not going to get, and you're certainly not going to get any response. And you're always going to be reaching for the sweets and not getting there.
So. That's much nicer than the squeaky wheels that we talk about. I much prefer shy kids don't get any sweets.
So there you go. And that's what I say to them. As long as you are sat there and thinking, okay, we've got this problem statement, because as a team, you should help come up with that. So what's our problem statement? What's it trying to do? And why are we doing it? And I would say if you're not used to working in this way, write it on a couple of sticky notes and stick it somewhere you can see it, you know, and just keep looking at it. And then looking at your work, either individually or as a team, and say, okay, is it doing this? Do we think it's going to do this? If your gut feeling, because that's crucial, right? If your gut feeling is saying, do you know, I think it is, then brilliant. You know, as a team, work it through. If your gut feeling's saying no, then again, discuss it as a team, and it's not too late to change tack, because it's better to change and try a different direction for something you do believe in than something you don't. And you can always go and see other people, other decision makers in the business, to get their view as well. You know, are we missing something here? What do you think of this? But if you don't start communicating, and I think I've seen a lot of people, you know, I guess more junior levels, come into a business and think they have, you know, no right to go and speak to senior decision makers. Of course they do. And senior decision makers, providing they've got the time and they're not in the middle of something, they love to talk to people and understand what's going on in those teams. So I would say, you know, be the change you want to see. Start writing down what the outcomes are that you're trying to achieve and why, and just start referring to them as you're working along. I think it's very, very important that you don't just sit there and be quiet.
Yeah. Well, I think you talk about openness, you talk about curiosity, transparency, vulnerability, right? Like, I think when you're building trust too, it's an excellent way to start. It's like, I don't know this, so I'm going to ask you questions. So that's a really unthreatening way to come. And it starts to prompt that feeling in the people around you. Like, oh, it was perfectly fine that Neil didn't know this. And I can therefore also be like, you know what I don't know is this, right? It really opens the doors in different ways.
Yeah. And especially when you go into a new company. If you do think like that, the best time is when you go into a new company, ask every single question you can think of in a short space of time. Because if you've got this complex that you're going to look a bit silly later, nobody looks silly when they enter a business. You can ask whatever you like.
You're new. We don't expect you to know.
Exactly.
And again, like you said, right? Sorry, and yeah. The new eyes, like you said, you only have new eyes once. And so that's a great time to look and ask questions for sure.
Totally, and get them to go all around the business, get them to go to the end-to-end journey. There's nothing worse than if you're employing somebody in design, or you're employing an engineer, or you're employing a product manager, they sit within their own teams, they don't go off and venture out, they don't see the end-to-end process, you know, go to the warehouses. That's something I've certainly instigated over the last year. I actually went to the warehouse 3 times before I joined the company. So just to find out, and then it was like, okay, guys, you've got to go down to the warehouse. And nobody had been. You know, it's like, well, how do you know what impact you're having on the warehouse? So go find out. And then suddenly the warehouse is like, God, this is brilliant. The operation's like, oh, we love products and design. We love it when they come down. We understand each other more. The conversations are so much more collaborative. You just shift hurdles out of the way that don't need to be there.
Well, and you really start to break down. I think one of the big signs where you know you have a problem is when it starts to be us and them. Right. Always. When everything's broken down to that, you think, oh, that's where we have a problem. And all the things that you talk about are really splitting that up and making it a team. Everybody's focused in the same spot.
Yeah. And also, if you think information is power, I've seen people do that. And actually, especially in some earlier times of product and design roles, you know, information is power. I'll tell you when I think you need to know. But if I know more, as a weapon versus a partner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. But some people do sit there and say, yeah, I've told you this much, but I'm not going to tell you the rest. But yeah, let's see how you go. And you just go over there and solve that with your design, you know, and all go and work that through with your business hound. And it just doesn't work, right?
No. My biggest pet peeve is data. People that like hoard data and then just drop data bombs at you. Like data that they know you would want to know and they could have shared with you to help you make other things. But instead they like just use it and you're like, what? Oh,
it's mind-blowing, isn't it? It's mind-blowing. People still do that, but I do see it occasionally. I really do. And, you know, I think that I run incredibly open teams, and I believe on the whole I do, but occasionally it crops up. And it's like, well, why are you not sharing this? You know, what do you think you're going to get if you go to some senior leader and say, oh, look what I've got? The first thing they're going to say is, well, have you shared it with the team, and how's that progressing? You know, so there's no point trying to hoard information to yourself. It's crazy.
All right. So we talked a little bit about maybe junior people kind of looking at outcomes. And one of the things that you also said was that this is, you can see that the industry is progressing here, but maybe not fast enough. So as design leaders, as business leaders, how can we help make that, how can we make it go faster?
Yeah. Well, those junior people are hopefully going to grow into senior leaders, right? So if you,
the rest of us are just going to have to retire out of the way. Is that what I'm hearing, Neil? There's no hope. Just wait for us to die off. It's fine.
whole natural attrition. Yeah, maybe. I think I'm in that camp as well, by the way. So.
Right. Yeah, together, we're selecting ourselves out.
I think really it's, you know, getting in from the off and even down to the interview. I think it's really crucial. And I discovered this too late, I think, but I'm glad I got onto it, is who decides, you know, how we work and what gets built? Who decides what eventually is designed and built? And if they turn around and say, well, you know, we work in a really good collaborative, outcome-focused teams, great. Start to probe that a bit more. If they turn around and go, well, you know, that's down to the head of product or the product manager, and you know, you're there to design, you know, around those problems with them. You know, you're onto a bit of a loser and a bit of a blocker, and that's not going to get better. Mm. But it doesn't mean it's not impossible to break down. So you make your choice depending on what opportunities you have. So I would say, on the one hand, probe it within the interview, and you'll know whether or not that's the kind of place you want to work. And you should be doing that anyway. But, you know, if you're new into this world, it's, I think, a really good learning experience to start doing that. I think if you go into a job and you're seeing it's not working that way, then get some YouTube videos, show people what you mean. You know, if you can't explain it yourself, get them to understand or steal some of their slides that they're offering to the world, you know, that it's like, I've done this conference, these slides are yours, go, you know, deliver to your teams and show people, if you can't explain it yourself that well, and why you think it'll work differently, and then try it. The one great thing is you don't have to convince a whole company that this is the way you're going to go. Try it on a single project. You know, try on just something small to begin with. So something that, you know, one project out of the 10 that's probably been worked on at the time, and then see how it works and see how that team is together against the other teams. You know, what's the morale like? What's the collaboration like? Are they inspiring each other? Is it a better working way? Are they just happier coming into work and doing their job? Because there's no better barometer, really.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We talked about lots of different things today, Neil. If you were going to have people do two things differently tomorrow based on what we talked about today, what would it be?
I would say if you're hearing about outcomes for the first time, please go on and watch some great, you know, videos from either the Silicon Valley Product Group or the Mind the Product team, because they are heavily geared towards UX design and product. Learn about what they're saying, understand it more. And then go back and preach the good word, show people these messages, show them the videos. And I would say, go and try it on a single project first. And then if that works, you've got something. You can go back and say, the reason this worked better to senior leaders is because we did this. And this is what it means. And it starts to grow from there.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes the proof is by doing it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to quote Nike, but just do it, right? I mean, If you don't start, you'll never get there.
Right. And again, like we talked about, if it fails, it doesn't mean the outcome failed. It's good learning. Like that's how we get through. It's an MVP. I always say every time, if all of our pilots work for the year, we did not do enough things. Like we didn't try. We didn't go far enough. We didn't push any edges. We played it safe. Right.
That is a brilliant way of saying it. Yeah, that's really good. I'm going to start using that one if that's okay.
Excellent. And I'm going to start saying that shy children don't get any sweets. So there we go. We've all got new sayings today. All right, Neil, it's been great. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for talking to us about outcomes. Thanks for talking about your journey and sharing your perspectives with us at Design Chats.
Thank you for having me. It's been brilliant to be here and talking to you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. All right. That does it for today's episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And don't forget to visit us at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.